Joining me here today is Charlie Morris, your head of multi-asset at Atlantic House Fund Management. You're also founder of Bytetree.com. Previously, you were head of global asset management for Absolute Return at HSBC. Is that right? And you're also editor of the Fleet Street Letter. You served as officer in the Grenadier Guards as well. On your LinkedIn.
A long time ago.
On your LinkedIn, I like the way you put it. You said it was an MBA, but you have to wear green clothes.
Correct.
You stand by that. I'd like to just quickly touch on the Fleet Street Letter. You're the editor there at the moment. What is the Fleet Street Letter and why is it important?
It was founded in 1937, I can tell you, not by me. Mm-hmm. And it was there to do sort of political analysis. And they predicted the Second World War was one of the great things before everyone else did, pretty much. And it's a title that's been up and down over the years. In the 80s, it had a huge subscription under Nigel Ray, who became a sort of famous entrepreneur in various things. And then it sort of had a bit of a downer. And the owner of South Bank Research is Bill Bonner, a Texan entrepreneur. And he owns many, many titles. And he always wanted the Fleet Street Letter to be to be special and to be good. And I was very, very honored when he invited me to write it. And I've always enjoyed writing. And so I thought I'd take up the challenge. I kind of approached it from the idea of the sort of 1990s stockbroking model. Back in those days, before the internet was prevalent in our lives and before regulation was so heavy in financial services, you had a chat with your broker about what was going on, and you'd talk about this stock and that stock, and all the client portfolios would be different. And so they would have 20 stocks or something like that, and the other guy would have different ones depending what he sort of felt was interesting. And it was a kind of haphazard world. And now what we have is wealth management, where everyone's got the same portfolio and index funds and these kind of things. And it's all much more structured. But I thought, well, the modern way of organizing the portfolios is probably for the best. But I thought the old school way of the conversation with the client was probably equally for the best.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to have a sort of, a modern portfolio using exchange-traded funds, being diversified and all that kind of stuff, but also having an informal conversation with the reader about what's happening in markets. The same sort of conversation I remember the partners doing when I was a youngster. Yeah. In stockbroking.
And you emphasize that you like freedom to write. Why do you think that's really important in today's world?
Well, I think that if you're a great footballer, then you should play a lot of football and practice. And if you're a great musician, you should spend a lot of time practicing your instrument. And I think in fund management, it might sound strange, but until you write down your views, you don't really know what they are. Yeah. And so having the discipline of writing every week is really quite important to frame where you are. And you're often changing your mind. So you can say something one week, and then the next week you have to stop and reverse and say, well, that didn't work out so well, and carry on a new line. But you're always doing that.
Yeah.
And if you're scared to change your mind, then you are going to struggle.
Yeah, and you have this conversation. The idea is to bring it back to the conversations a stockbroker would have with his client, sort of tailored to the audience.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you can't have an individual conversation when you've got a large readership.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you try and have the sort of generic conversation you would start.
Yeah.
And I just remember those days, in the 90s when I started in the fund management business, and the partners just buttering up their clients and saying nice things and telling a joke and then talking about the markets, and so you try and put all those things into it, and so it's an interesting read.
Yeah.
For the reader, it's not just about money. There's also a few other things that creep in here and there.
Yeah.
And we're allowed the odd joke too.
Yeah. And it makes it more interesting for the readers.
Yeah.
I noticed that one idea you touched on is to have a whiskey portfolio and a soda portfolio. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I left HSBC and I was thinking about how I was going to do this. And I wanted to have a simple portfolio that didn't do much, that did the job, but you didn't have to be very involved. And then I thought that if you did that, and it's the great long-term solution, that's a soda portfolio, then the whiskey portfolio would be more interesting. And so it'd give us something to write about. Because if you just have the best thing to do in investment is to buy some good things and just leave them and go and get on with your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's very boring. So so particularly when you're writing a newsletter. So I wanted to have the whiskey portfolio would be alive and kicking and changing, a trade here and a trade there.
Yeah.
To keep everyone engaged and give us a conversation. And the soda portfolio to be to be something much more stable over time. So the idea was that you sort of mixed to taste. Mm. And so if you wanted to have a higher risk portfolio, you'd have more whiskey and less soda. But generally speaking, it was advised, you know, take 80% in soda and 20% in whiskey, as you probably would if you were a whiskey and soda drinker, which I'm not, by the way.
So what would a whiskey sort of portfolio, one or two things in a whiskey portfolio look like today?
Well, you'd get some UK stocks. Yeah. So you'd have some major UCs. So FTSE 350, the top 350 companies in Britain, we would have typically between 6 and 10 of those. And then there would be something in the precious metal space, some gold shares, maybe some, at the moment we've got some platinum. And then also there'd be some overseas themes such as oil or technology, and also some country funds. So we're big into Russia at the moment.
Okay. Why are you into Russia at the moment?
It's a cheap market, and you know, one of the big problems in the world is debt. And because Russia had sanctions a few years ago, they're basically not allowed to issue dollar debt, so that's kept them out of trouble.
Wow.
So you've got a very, very cheap market that's already had a lot of bad news priced into it. Actually, the Russian economy is doing quite well in a post-sanctions environment, and it's kind of different. And the fact that it's different means it's a diversifier. Mm. So if you own Britain and then you want to put money into France and Germany, well, they're kind of the same. So you haven't actually achieved much in diversification. To put Russia alongside British stocks is probably a much better thing to do.
Yeah. How do you identify like a Russian company and mitigate or take into account like the risk that usually people associate with Russian companies?
Well, the market's good at doing that, and so Russian companies are really cheap.
Ah,
yeah, so you can buy Russian oil companies, and you know that there might be some governance issues that wouldn't be acceptable in Europe or America, but nonetheless, you know, you're not paying much for it, so therefore that's why it all starts to work. And ultimately, over the long term, provided the asset gets to stand the test of time, if you pay a low price for something, then it ought to end up well.
Yeah. And so before your HSBC, could you tell us something? You know, you were there from up until 2015, if that's right.
That's right, yeah.
And so you must have been head of a department at HSBC, a huge bank, during 2008. Do you have any interesting stories from that time, or before or after?
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, the end of 2007, we knew there was a slowdown coming. We reduced a lot of risk. And then going into 2008, you know, we thought, well, we cracked this one. We've got the right portfolio for this market. And then the summer in 08, there was a lot of talk about things starting to improve. And I think me and many others actually made the odd mistake here and there and actually started to put risk, didn't put a lot of risk back into the portfolio, but some in. And then that quickly turned sour. And many of the things that you thought were going to hold up well, like corporate bonds and so on, didn't. I mean, everything went down really, really badly. Mm. The only thing that worked out well really were government bonds. And of course, this time, the next time we have a problem in markets, the government bonds, the yields are so low now that they're unlikely to protect you. So finding protection for portfolio is much more challenging now than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Where do you think we're at now in the current economy? Do you concern yourself really with that much? Or?
Well, markets and economies are very different things. And, you know, for example, quantitative easing, which came from the credit crisis, has done wonderful things for markets. Yeah, because essentially the government bought loads of bonds off investors, and those investors had to go and buy riskier assets in return. So as that process took place, then, you know, asset prices rose. But there's recently, you know, we've got more and more evidence that actually QE has had zero impact on the real economy. So the normal person with their lives and their job and their income, QE really hasn't done anything for them at all. It's really only focused on financial markets. And now what's happening is the economy in places like Britain and America is stronger than people think it should be. And that's just part of the normal cycle. But then there are areas of the world where it's really starting to turn down. For example, in Asia, you know, China's slowing down, and also that has a big impact on places like Germany that sell things to China. And so that's where we've got a bit of a problem. And you see things like, you know, global trade really under pressure. It's falling quite rapidly. And you've got different things in markets. So, for example, if you're a shipping company or a auto producer or something, that's really bad news to see a slowdown in China. But if you're making software in America, then you just don't care. It just doesn't impact you. If you're doing computer games or Netflix or something, the number of customers you have got nothing to do with Chinese trade.
Yeah. Do you think it's important to emphasize that there is a distinction between markets and the economy, and people sometimes do get confused that
of course they're linked in the long run, but the link is not as immediate and as clear as people like to think it is. So what's impacting growth stocks is you know, greed and fear much more so, and valuations and these sorts of things. It's much more important than what's affecting, you know, an oil stock or an industrial stock.
Yeah.
And they are really completely different.
So what you do now as head of multi-asset, how does that differ from a title such as head of absolute return? What are the differences?
Well, the word absolute return sort of went out of favor. So you know, multi-asset came in favor. And I run a total return fund now rather than absolute return fund. I guess they're the same thing, but you know, terminology shifts and moves and evolves.
Yeah.
And you know, we're trying to make a fund that's got low volatility, that's, you know, a reliably a profit maker.
Yeah.
Now I hate to say in all market conditions, because that's an exaggeration, you know, but I think the point about a total return fund is if the worst scenario comes, you'll be much better off in a total return fund than in a normal one. Mm. But similarly, if the market races away, you'll be pretty disappointed in a total return fund because it's not actually going to make you that much money. Yeah. It's more of a sort of savings device, an advanced savings device, rather than something to make you rich.
Yeah. At the moment, growth stocks are really popular, and you probably have some views on growth stocks. You also probably have some views on cryptocurrencies. One of your articles recently, you compared cryptocurrencies to social media stocks. Why do you think they're similar?
Well, going back to the beginning, you know, I sort of split my world into four asset groups.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of them's gold yeah. bars. One of them's value stocks. And value stocks kind of means anything that's you can touch. So it's a sort of factory or a mine or an oil well, even a bank to some extent. And then you then get quality assets, which are more ideas, and growth assets, which are more ideas. So a quality asset is, you know, might make toothpaste. So it's all about the brand. You know, the toothpaste isn't particularly valuable, but it's sold at a much higher price than it's made. Now, that's not true in industrial goods. They're sold at a marginally higher price than that they're made for. Mm. And you'd get branded goods and, you know, fizzy drinks and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you get growth stocks, which could be, you know, software, or it could be support services. You know, we're sitting here in the city of London. This is, you know, we're growth stocks are all around us,
yeah.
Right here. And this is about human ingenuity rather than stuff that you can touch.
Yeah.
You know, advertising, media, all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And those four groups of investing are completely different from each other.
Yeah.
And they behave differently for different conditions. So, for example, if inflation is rising, which means that money is getting less valuable, you'd much rather own gold and industrials. Because a cement plant, you know, if the economy falls apart, then a cement plant's still a cement plant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, when the economy recovers, everyone's going to want cement again. So in a sense, you never lost any money. You just, you know, you've got a slightly older cement plant than you started with.
Yeah.
And so that's resilient to inflation and so on. But if inflation is low, that means money's good. And if money's good, then people want more of it.
Yeah.
Now, it might sound strange to say that, but, you know, if you're in Turkey or Venezuela where money's not good, then would you chase a strategy that made more money? Not really, because it's not, you know, you really want it. You'd rather have a cement plant.
Yeah.
And that's kind of logical. The thing about growth stocks in particular is they are the opposite of gold. So when you expect growth stocks to do really, really well, when the economy is doing well and when money's good, then you'd expect gold to be doing badly. And in the opposite scenario, when the economy turns down and the value, you know, inflation starts to pick up, you'd expect gold to do much, much better. And so if you actually owned growth stocks alongside gold bars, you've got a better portfolio than if you owned one or the other on its own.
Yeah.
My anecdote, over the last 20 years, gold's up four times, the NASDAQ's up five times, but a 50-50 portfolio is up six times, you know, if you rebalance once a year. And that's the power of diversification. Now, if they were the same, so if you own gold and silver, or, you know, British growth stocks and American growth stocks, you know, you wouldn't have had that benefit.
Yeah. How do you rebalance each year? I mean,
The good one, so let's say gold goes up and tech goes down. So at the end of the year, you're no longer 50-50, you're now 60-40 in one way or another. You just go back to 50-50. So you sell the one that's done well and you buy the one that's done badly.
Yeah.
And that's always a good thing to do, portfolio rebalancing, provided the underlying assets are one day going to be good.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do that into something that's going to zero, that's not going to work out too well.
No.
But provided both things long term are great.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you rebalance the FTSE and the Russian market, or the Chinese market with the Brazilian market or something, over time, by doing rebalancing, you'd be better off than if you just did one on their own.
Yeah. At the moment, are you excited more about traditional asset classes, or are you more excited about where cryptocurrency is going?
Well, crypto intrigued me. I mean, I discovered it in 2011. And a friend of mine who's an economist said, He said, you've got to check this thing out. And I said, don't be ridiculous, because if you've got money on the internet, you can cut and paste it, and you've got two monies. That's not going to work. And then I came back to it in 2013, realizing I'd made a terrible mistake. And the reason why that's not true is because of blockchain. So I built a software company to analyze it, because I was very intrigued by the whole thing. I wanted to know why Bitcoin, you know, what drove it, what was important to it. And I quickly realized that it was the network that was important. So the more people that use Bitcoin, not the more people that buy Bitcoin, this is crucial, but the more people that use it, makes it valuable. So if the network is buzzing around, then the price rises. And if people get bored of it, then the price falls, regardless of how much money they've put into it or not. And if you do the analysis, that means that Bitcoin basically correlates with internet stocks.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes Bitcoin a growth asset. And as I've already said, growth and gold are opposite assets. And so when people talk about Bitcoin being the new gold, I think they're mistaken, because one is driven by network effect, and it's very similar to a company like Facebook or WhatsApp or Snapchat, which is all about users.
Yeah. Yeah.
And gold is just a permanent store of value.
Yeah.
Gold is a really boring certainty. Yeah. You know, it's not going to make you rich. It's going to keep you rich. Whereas Bitcoin is going to make you rich.
So
that's not a buy Bitcoin, by the way.
Why do you think it's important to emphasize that it's not as similar to gold as people may think, or different?
Well, because on the thing about Bitcoin, it was designed around the idea of gold on the supply side.
Yes.
And so you've got this, you know, 21 million coins maximum, or 17.5 million or something like that now. And actually, we're not 17.5, we're 16 million, because 1.5 have never touched the network, but that's another point. The fact that you can't have too many Bitcoins in the world makes it a very low inflation instrument. It's about 4% at the moment, and then next year it's going to drop to about 2. So every 4 years, the inflation rate will halve, more or less. And so that's given the system confidence. And that squeeze on supply has been important to lifting the price. But by my estimates, about 90% of the growth in the Bitcoin price is because of demand factors, and about 10% is because of those supply factors. Mm. Yeah, so it's far more important to study the network than it is to study the supply changes. Mm. Now, there are people out there talking about stock to flow being the most important thing in Bitcoin, and the halving next year and so on. The halving is important, and it should boost the price by, according to my estimates, 2.3 times. But we might be already seeing that in the recent strength. But actually, you know, people talk about stock to flow, saying, well, how many Bitcoins are there? How many new ones are coming each year? It's just the same as saying inflation, just inverting the equation. And so, you know, I think the correct way to describe it is Bitcoin started off with very high inflation when there was one Bitcoin, and the next day there were, you know, or there were 50 actually. There were 50 on the first block. And by the end of the day, there were, you know, loads of Bitcoins. And so the inflation rate was sort of infinite.
Yeah.
But over time, that number has come crashing down. It's now about 4, as I said, and going to 2, and eventually tending towards 0 over the next century. And so, you know, that really has given the whole space confidence and scarcity, in the same way that fine art does, or, you know, whatever, because there's not too much of it.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's been the value driver, because you can launch a coin next door to Bitcoin with the same characteristics, which has the same supply constraints, but it's worthless.
Yeah.
And that's because it's got no network.
I see. And so right now at Bytetree, what exactly are you doing with Bytetree.com?
So Bytetree is a... Well, it's funny enough, because we're just looking over the road, I can see the Bloomberg building. Yeah. It's the Bloomberg for crypto. I hate to say that expression, but it kind of is. I sit in front of a Bloomberg all day doing normal financial markets, and it's like, well, where's crypto? And so I said, well, I go and build it.
Nice.
And so we spent a few years doing this now, and we've got a small team, and it's one major one lead tech guy. And I've got a DevOps guy, and we've got a lot of part-time helpers, including myself. So I run the project, but I've got a whipping boy, the chief operating officer, who hits it on the stick, and I've got a quant guy who's just got numbers all over his place. And so I put these people together, and we've got, you know, a product that's evolving quite rapidly. So we're going to have a new front end shortly, and essentially what we're going to end up having is a whole load of different cryptos, the major ones with a network worth measuring, and to give the, you know, straight from the blockchain live details of what's happening and why. And so you can value Bitcoin, you can see it grow, you can see it contract, you can see the miners selling it. Everything you want to know if you were a trader.
Yeah, so Bytetree is essentially measuring what's going on behind crypto and everything you want to know is just there in one place? Why do you think no one's doing that at the moment besides you?
Well, we are.
Yeah, besides you.
I think there are various things all over the place in crypto. There are sites littered all over the place. Mm. And I think by trying to do it, what you see a lot of are these sites like CoinMarketCap, and then it's got various friends, where they list the coins, list the prices, have a few charts and volume statistics. What we're doing is going inside the blockchain, deciphering what the activity is, and turning into economic analysis. So we can tell you the GDP of Bitcoin economy, the inflation rate I've already mentioned. We're tracking the miners. We know exactly how many Bitcoins the miners are sitting on any one time. We can tell you whether they're selling them, and you can actually watch the site and each block as it comes through and see what they're up to.
Yeah.
So, for example, last November, when the Bitcoin price crashed below 6,000, we picked up immediately that was driven. The reason why Bitcoin crashed below 6,000 initially was because one of the miners, and I haven't analyzed exactly who, but I can tell you the wallet address, dumped a whole lot of coins, far more than they had been mining. And so that excess dumping of inventory caused the price break. And the price went down to 3,000. It's now recovering back to 6,000, and it's very likely that because we're back to that former level, that it's going to pause for a bit. But long term, one's got to be really bullish on crypto, because it's just the internet, as I've already described, and you've got to be bullish on the internet because it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So crypto will just get bigger and bigger and bigger. Even if Bitcoin hits a wall for some reason or another, something in crypto will end up being absolutely enormous.
Yeah. So what at the moment, besides crypto, of course, and general investing, what's got you most excited? Russia, you mentioned, is really interesting. You got crypto. Is there anything else that's really caught your attention?
Well, this bull market's really old.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 10 years old, and we don't like the price of stocks, generally speaking. I mean, you've got this value growth divergence that's been going on for since 2009, pretty much. And that is that growth stocks are really expensive. The quality stocks, the companies that make, I was going to say baked beans, but that's the wrong example. But companies that make toothpaste and fizzy drinks historically are very, very high valuations. Mm. And some of it's a good reason because your interest rates are low, so therefore you'd expect that. But also the fact that because interest rates are low, then it's very cheap to borrow. So those companies used to make less money because they used to pay more for borrowing. And you could argue also that wages aren't as high as they should be in the Western world, and therefore companies are getting a good deal at the moment.
Yeah.
Labor prices were higher in other decades. And so you put those things together, cheap credit, low corporate taxes, and lower wages, and so companies are absurdly profitable at the moment, particularly in America, where it's pretty out of hand. And so these companies are trading on valuations that are historically abnormal, and then you've got growth stocks where it's all the rage because, as I said earlier, there's a problem in China and so on. If you're some .com in Silicon Valley, you just don't care. It doesn't matter to you.
Yeah.
So it's a safe haven against. You're not going to cancel your Microsoft account, are you? Because of shipping problems in Asia or something.
Yeah.
If the economy gets bad, it's going to be pretty bad before you cancel your Microsoft subscription.
Yeah.
And so that's why these stocks are seen as extreme safe havens. So I think that the fact that one just very uncomfortable with asset prices in general is something that is probably the thing that's on my mind. In terms of exciting opportunities, another time for that. this is the time to be thinking more defensively. And our biggest position in our fund is gold.
Interesting. So would you say the thing you're most worried about at the moment? Just asset prices absurdly?
Yeah, and also companies. The dollar. So the US dollar wants to go higher. Now, is this a UK audience or is it a global audience?
UK and global.
Yeah. So sitting in the UK, we've got our own specific problem with our currency because of Brexit. And the pound's gone down, but it probably doesn't deserve to be as low as it is. It'd probably be happier, a lot higher against the euro and a bit higher against the dollar. And so that's our own problem, which will be resolved, I imagine, when there's a political deal. So that's the politics, which is kind of boring. Mm. And it's been dragging on for too long. But so once that's resolved, we should see a higher pound. But let's leave that aside and just think about most currencies versus the dollar. There's this idea that a lot of countries have been borrowing dollars because it's been cheap to do so in recent years, and they've now got to pay them back. And so the world is kind of short dollars, as it were. And whenever things start to get ugly, the dollar wants to rise. It's the natural safe haven. It's the currency with an interest rate because they've been hiking rates for a while. They talked about it in 2013 and they've been doing it since. And they've got all the way up to 275, I think, the last time I checked.
Yeah,
sounds about right. And most of the world are still at zero. So Japan, Eurozone, and so on, we're still on zero interest rates. And here in the UK, it's a little bit higher at 75 basis points. But generally speaking, most currencies are pretty low. And I think that the there's a strong case that the dollar wants to rally. And that effectively is like a big squeeze on the global economy. You know, it's a strangulation effect.
Yeah.
If you think, go back to 2001 to 2007 era before the credit crisis, you know, America was the last place to invest. American stock market was a laggard. Tech stocks were tedious. People preferred mining stocks. The place to be was India, Brazil, China, these sort of places. You know, the story was about how many people and the growth and the excitement of the world. Yeah. Africa was exciting. Middle East was everything was exciting. Even people, you know, there were scams about North Korean bonds. It was so funny. But, you know, there's all this stuff went on. And the dollar was sinking during that time. So if you think about that era, which lasted quite a long time, you know, the dollar was sinking, and so that was a breath of fresh air to the world economy. Really, really good for emerging markets. And so dollar strength is the exact opposite situation. It's a big strangulation event. And so the moment when things get nasty, the dollar seems to want to go up, which is unhelpful.
Yeah. I remember you once said to me, when everything's going well, you should start to worry. And when everything's going wrong, then you don't actually need to worry anymore. Do you feel like everything's going well?
I try my hardest to think like that, but you know, it's more of a dream. You know, you always worry, but you should try and invert your opinion as best you can.
Yeah. Do you agree with the statement that sort of in the long run markets are a weighing machine as opposed to in the short term they're just a voting machine? Does that affect your thinking at all?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you know, we're all living in the voting machine because, you know, we're all interested in short-term results.
Yeah.
And that, as time has told, is proven, is probably not the best way to do things all the time. But at the moment, the cheapest stocks, the value stocks, which have been underperforming since 2009, which are really, really cheap by historic standards, they just go down.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they you look at these things and you go, you get all that company, all those factories, all that stuff for that? Wow, amazing. And guess what? It will go down.
Yeah.
And you look at the growth stocks and it's been the other way.
Yeah.
You know, nonsense valuations, these IPOs coming from things like Uber and these food delivery companies. I mean, these are people riding bicycles. Yeah. And you're telling me that's a tech stock. How's that a tech stock?
Yeah. It's an interesting time we're in. Do you think capital markets is at the moment, this is a very broad question, but I just want to sort of finish with this. Do you think capital markets at the moment, first off, are operating as well as they should be?
I think they're, you know, free market's a free market.
Yeah.
You know, you can't fault the market. There's a whole lot of people on one side and a whole lot of people on the other side, and they have a punch up and the result is the price.
Yeah.
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 And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you could criticize central bank policy.
Yep.
Which is, you know, rates are too low across the board. And as I said earlier, there's no evidence that it's helped the people. It's just helped the market.
And it's helped IPOs reach multi-billion dollar
values. IPO cycles always tend to come at the end.
Yep.
So, you know, when the IPOs are coming to the market at big numbers, then that's usually the last bit. And we haven't really had a strong IPO era since the late 90s, like 1990s. There've been bursts here and there, but the late 90s was off the scale. I mean, it was far worse than today.
Yeah.
I mean, really rubbish companies with no profits coming to market at huge numbers.
Okay.
And so many of them. But I guess the world's a bit more regulated now. I say my criticism of the IPOs today, they are coming through at high prices, but the companies come at, you know, after all the good bits been done. So you're seeing Uber, you know, pretty much rolled out in over 100 cities or something.
Yeah.
And I think London's number five, isn't it? Or is that Paris?
One
or
of the first four, few, for
yeah.
sure.
And you know, they've done all the hard work. So all the value's being created, and now it comes to market. So in the good old days, you know, you might get a young company. I mean, Microsoft came to market in, what, 86, 87?
Yeah.
As a young company.
Before it was the giant it is today.
Yeah. And so if you bought those shares and held them for a long period of time, I mean, fabulous.
Yeah.
But you just don't get that these days. They just come too big. And I guess that's one of the reasons why people love crypto so much, is because you do get the opportunity to go in and get in early.
Yeah.
And so if the thing works out, you will benefit.
Yeah.
And that's just not true if you buy shares in Uber.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, low interest rates, you criticizing central bank policy, do you think that definitely plays a factor in what's going on in the economy in terms of big valuations of these companies?
Absolutely, because you know the discount rate. I mean, if you have low rates, then prices should be high.
Yeah.
If you have high rates, I mean, it's not a coincidence that share prices were their lowest level in you know anyone living today in 1982 when interest rates and inflation were through the roof.
Yeah,
back at that time, and that's when shares, all shares, were really, really cheap. Coca-Cola was on 1x sales, and today that same company would be on 6.5x sales.
Yeah. So, for investors who want to subscribe to the Fleet Street Letter, where should they go to? Where should they head?
I don't know. Type it into Google. I'm sure it'll pop up somewhere.
And
most people are trying to get rid of it from their Google. You know, it's in your face. Please subscribe. You know.
And Bytetree as well, they can just find it on www.
Bytetree is free, just log in. B-Y-T-E, Bytetree. So it's a nice little money tree, which is kind of a euphemism for cryptos.
Did you, why did you feel like you wanted to make it free for the world to see all your hard work behind getting this information out there?
Because I've got a friend who runs a tech fund. And he said, if you do a subscription service, you know, you might get some subscriptions and you could make, you know, this thing could be worth $10 million or something. But if you give it away free, it could be worth $1 billion. and that's the economics of the internet, right?
Yeah, that's the economics of how everything works.
Yeah, you're better off being big. But there's a more serious point, and that is that if I want to sell subscriptions, I've got to pay a salesman. I haven't got one.
Yeah.
I need an account management system. I need customer support.
Yeah.
I need all this stuff.
Yeah.
It's actually really complex.
It's harder.
It's harder.
Yeah.
It's easier just to give it away.
Yeah.
And you know, do everyone a favor. And then there are loads of applications that we can build on top. So I think once we finish the minimum viable product, the MVP, which will be pretty imminent this summer, I hope, and we'd have added loads of coins. But by the time that's done, then we're going to start to look at doing loads of partnerships with people. But I think you know the principle is that the data didn't cost us anything. So, you know, what we've done is process it, which has taken a long time. It's been a lot of effort. But I think you can take the whole thing to the next stage with a series of joint ventures, and those could all be things that you know you have to pay for.
Yeah.
But I think this bottom layer, I mean, price is free, right? I mean, price is free all over the place, so I can't charge for that. And then, you know, why bother charging for blockchain data? I mean, I'll get 10 happy customers, but you know, the 10 million people will never know what it is.
Yeah, and then you won't get the, you know, $1 billion valuation.
There you go. So maybe the IPO window can hold on for a bit longer.
We'll keep that IPO window just open enough long enough for you. Well, great. It was a pleasure having you, Charlie.
Thanks for spending
your time to be here with us today and sharing your thoughts with our audience and the investors.
My pleasure.
Thanks for coming.